Your dreams are bigger, bolder, and more badass than the life you're living now, but something just keeps getting in the way. Join certified coach and former therapist Diane Wingert for the Driven Woman podcast. She'll show you how to get rid of whatever is holding you back so you can stop spinning your wheels and up-level your life. Get ready to hop in and buckle up. This is the Driven Woman podcast, and we're heading for the fast lane.
Well, hey there, and welcome back to The Driven Woman. Today is a solo episode, and it is one where I finally answer the question that I'm probably asked as a guest on other people's podcast more than any other question. You want to guess what it is, or shall I just cut to the chase and tell you? Okay, I'm just going to tell you. People want to know, what is the difference between a therapist and a coach? When is it appropriate to work with a therapist versus working with a coach? And obviously, I'm uniquely qualified to answer this question because I have been a coach for the last 5 years. And prior to that, I was a licensed psychotherapist for over 20. So I know a thing or two, and people are absolutely fascinated with the topic. It turns out there's way more controversy and way more confusion than I actually realized. So there's a little bit of a public service announcement aspect to this particular episode, because I have become aware that far too many people are actually working with the wrong kind of helper through nobody's fault. It's just, as it turns out, what the average person doesn't understand about the difference between therapy and coaching, and even what most therapists and coaches don't understand about the difference, can at the least do no good, and at the worst, cause harm. Now, I'm not a doctor, I've never been a doctor, nor do I play one on TV, and so I have never taken the Hippocratic Oath, which is first do no harm. But as a licensed therapist, I was heavily regulated by the state, carried malpractice insurance, and could absolutely be sued by anyone even thinking I might have done them harm while they were a client of mine. So it is a very, very, very important topic, and one I think it was about time I just went ahead and addressed, not just on other people's podcasts, but right here on my own, on The Driven Woman. So I gave you a couple of little teasers in that preview, but we're going to break this down step by step by step. I'm going to try to cover all the questions that you might have about it, or maybe didn't even realize you had until I brought it up. And because this is such an important topic, and because I, as an ethical practitioner, really genuinely want everyone who needs help, wants help, and is willing to get help to get it from the right kind of person, I welcome you, any of you, DM me on Instagram at Coach Diane Wingert, or if you want to steer clear of social media, send me an email at diane@dianewingertcoaching.com, and I will personally answer your questions. But I want you to listen to this whole episode first, okay? Because chances are, I will address it in this episode. So, from the top, you've probably heard it said, and if you're a coach, this might be a little cringeworthy for you, but the absolute truth is anybody who wants to call themselves a coach can do so. You don't even have to have a high school diploma. You don't even have to be an adult, actually. Anybody who wants to call themselves a coach can call themselves a coach. The reason for that is, as of the recording of this episode, 2022, coaching is still an unregulated industry. Now, there are several prominent groups, ICF being the most well-known, International Coach Federation. They are trying very hard to become the gold standard, to become the regulatory body for the coaching industry. And if that is to happen, then everyone who wants to call themselves a coach in the future would have to be an ICF certified coach. I don't see that happening anytime soon. I know there's a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt on this whole topic. referring back to a previous episode about fear, uncertainty, and doubt. I think there are a lot of organizations that are stirring up a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt among people who want to be coaches and have convinced many of them that they need to be certified by ICF or their organization or some organization in order to practice safely and ethically as a coach. That may or may not be true. There is no guarantee that any coaching program you go through, even if you go through multiple coaching programs in person, online, hybrid, I happen to know of a number of people who have multiple coaching certifications. They still do not feel competent and confident as a coach. I also, for the record, know of therapists who, in spite of their significantly greater training, supervision, and regulation, also don't feel confident in their work. This makes it even more confusing, right? Because isn't the whole point of getting training, regardless of which field you go into, so that you can practice in a competent and confident way? Well, you would think so. Now, as I said, coaches don't actually need to be certified. They don't actually need to be trained. Plenty of people just think they're good at giving advice, or they have an enviable lifestyle, or they've done something that other people don't seem to be able to do. And so they call themselves a coach and start helping other people do it. As of right now, there's any different type of coach you could possibly imagine. There are dog training coaches. There are guitar coaches. There are gardening coaches. There are copywriting coaches. There are online business coaches. There are visibility coaches. There are confidence coaches, leadership coaches, and there are also trauma coaches, relationship coaches, addictions coaches, overcoming narcissistic abuse coaches, and binge eating coaches. There are all these different types of coaches. Now, that's where I start to get a little concerned for the potential client, for the consumer, because, and I go back to this, you do not have to have any training whatsoever as a coach. You don't. And a lot of coaches are very happy to report all of the trainings they've gone through, all of the credentials they have, all of the life experience they have, all of the certifications they have. But at the end of the day, if you hire them, if you work with them, and you are psychologically harmed, there's not a damn thing you can do about it because it's an unregulated industry. Now, if you are the kind of person who would take to social media and start badmouthing that person, I suppose that's one way you could try to get justice. But there's no legal recourse because there's no credentialing body that has legal right to oversee and to enforce. So let's talk about how a therapist becomes a therapist. Now, unlike the coach, where anybody can be one, and by the way, I'm not bad-mouthing coaching. I represent myself currently as a coach. I've been working as a coach for the last 5 years, and I know many, many coaches that are highly skilled, very ethical, they practice with integrity, and they get good results. They have good reputations for a reason. And I know a lot of coaches who literally are making it up as they go along, and if they get a bad outcome, they blame it on the client. Directly or indirectly. I also know therapists, licensed therapists with master's or even PhDs and years of experience who are mediocre at best. So it's really very confusing to know what to do. And that's why I wanted to talk about it. So if you seek out or are engaged in any way with a licensed therapist, that person has at a minimum a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, plus 2 years of practice supervised by a licensed clinician. They will have taken 2 state exams and they need to renew their license every 2 years and not just pay a fee to renew, but they need to do continuing education units so that their skills and their awareness is up to date as they continue to practice. Most ethical clinicians will also be in some sort of a peer group, even though once you're licensed, it is no longer required that you have anyone supervise you legally. Most ethical clinicians, especially those in private practice, will choose to be part of a peer review group. I was part of a peer review group while I was in private practice with several of the most highly reputable clinicians in my area. And we met every month and we talked about our most difficult cases because nobody has all the answers and nobody can see all of their own blind spots. And even after all the training that we have as licensed therapists, everybody has blind spots because we are all still human. One of the concerns I have, and I recently spoke about this in a couple of different podcast interviews on other shows, one of the concerns that I have about the current state of the coaching industry is that a lot of coaches are venturing into territory that has been the traditional purview of therapists. And I'm speaking specifically of abuse, trauma, loss, and a whole gamut of addictions. I'm concerned about this because the potential for harm is great even when you are a licensed therapist with clients who have these issues. All of us are by now familiar with seeing hashtag trigger warning all over social media. This is not just a cultural phenomenon. It is a result of the fact that there are a tremendous number of people walking around at any given time who are in some state of trauma, healed, partially healed, in a current state of exacerbation of unhealing, or they've had a new trauma that has completely reset their inner mechanisms as though they were experiencing their original trauma. These individuals require a really, really high level of work, of boundaries, of awareness, of skill. And I do not personally feel comfortable referring to coaches for this. I also, by the way, do not refer to the vast majority of therapists. Now, my point is not to be holier than thou, to act superior, to hold myself above others, or to imply or state that my standards are higher than other people's. I just know that even though I am no longer regulated by the state because I am no longer working as a licensed therapist, I prefer to continue to operate under the same guidelines that are required of a therapist. Here's a couple of examples. You can go out to coffee with your coach if you want. Hell, you can go out for drinks. You can't even acknowledge a therapy client in public or you would risk losing your license. The reason for this is the level of confidentiality and privacy that are just simply part of the modality of therapy. So anything that is said to a licensed therapist is held in strict confidence with three exceptions. One, if you disclose to your therapist abuse or neglect, therapists are mandated reporters. They have to report it. There are statutes of limitations, and that's more complex than I want to get into in this episode. But a therapist is a mandated reporter. So under those conditions, they have to breach the confidentiality. And they will tell their client, I'm unable to keep this between us because this is the law. Here's what I need to do. And at least how I did it, if I needed to call child services or I needed to call adult protective services or something like that, I would do so with the client right there in the office. So there was no secrecy about it. A coach has no confidentiality requirements whatsoever. Now, some coaches may choose to hold everything their clients tell them in confidence, but they are not obligated to do so. And while you might be very unhappy to see something you have said to your coach that you thought was in confidence shared on their podcast or on their social media or in their newsletter, you do not have a legal right to be upset about it. This is both good and bad because the confidentiality aspect of therapy is, I think, one of the reasons why it has stigma. I mean, there's a couple of reasons why. I think many people who probably know they should be going to see a therapist because they're dealing with abuse, trauma, serious loss, or addiction. And by the way, they are having symptoms and impairment as a result of those things. It's not just, oh, you've had abuse, trauma, loss, addiction, therefore you should always see a therapist and only see a therapist. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if you have experienced abuse, trauma, addiction, or loss, and you are currently experiencing symptoms and impairment, with very, very few exceptions, the person you should be seeing is a therapist. And not just any therapist, a person who specializes in that particular area. But I think one of the reasons why so many people don't want to see a therapist is because of the stigma. And the stigma is, at least in part, because of the level of confidentiality. There's something that many people sort of assume when something is really private and highly confidential, that feels like a secret. And especially for people who have been sexually abused in childhood, secrets feel scary. So even going to see a psychologist or a clinical social worker or a marriage family therapist to deal with your trauma may not feel safe because of that confidentiality. It's a little bit of a weird twist. But I also think that culturally, we don't do a good job of acknowledging the common nature of mental disorders and emotional conditions. Most people will experience a mental disorder in their lifetime, even if it's temporary and situationally specific. We really do not have a big, you know, difference between us and them. We are them, they are us. And at any given time in our lives, we may be more or less susceptible and vulnerable to experiencing symptoms of a mental disorder. But in reality, probably most people don't go see someone for all kinds of reasons: access to care, money, and stigma. The other reason, before I move on to another point, is that psychotherapy has been around for 100 years. Coaching's been around for maybe 20. And psychotherapy, for most of its history, is identified as part of the medical model. And what I mean by the medical model is, for many people, seeking therapy is thought of as only necessary when it is becomes a medical situation. And there's a term that insurance companies require where the therapy has to be seen as medically necessary, which means the person has to have a serious enough mental disorder that not treating it could be life-endangering. The vast majority of people don't meet that criteria. So I can tell you from my experience of being a therapist for over 20 years that oftentimes the therapist feels pressured, sometimes by the client themselves or by the agency they work with, the group practice they're part of, or the insurance company that they're aligned with. We may feel pressured to diagnose someone with a more serious condition than they actually have, simply so that their treatment can be covered by the insurance company and they can afford to keep receiving treatment. We have a long, long, long way to go when it comes to healthcare reform and parity for mental health conditions. No one should have to exaggerate the seriousness of emotional problems or mental condition so that the person could get care. But I've seen it happen many times. Something else I want to say about this is that it can be a little bit of a tricky business, you know, when should someone see a therapist? When should they see a coach? Would it ever be appropriate to work with both people at the same time? How would you deal with the boundaries and make sure there's not gaps or overlaps? Gaps are, well, I thought you were talking about that. No, I thought you were talking about that. Uh-oh. And overlaps is when both professionals are helping the same person deal with the same thing, which is actually more likely. But in all reality, people work with the person that they feel comfortable working with, or the person they can afford, or the person that their insurance company covers, or the person that their pastor recommends, or their sister went to. And most of the work that I absolutely consider therapeutic is done by bartenders, personal trainers, hairstylists, massage therapists. You know, there are legions of people out there who are performing a service for others. It may be a barber, it may be a bartender, it may be the person that's trying to help you lose weight and get in shape at the gym. It may be the person that's trying to work the kinks out of your neck. But it is an intimate relationship in that you are alone together oftentimes. There is a sense of vulnerability and the necessity of trust. I guess we could call it a pseudo-intimate relationship or a partially intimate relationship. But it is one where people, when they feel safe, when they feel a connection, when they trust the individual, will spill all kinds of secrets, will tell that other person all kinds of things. Are those folks trained therapists or even coaches? Hell no. They're human beings who are in a position where others confide in them. So I would never draw a hard line and say, you can't talk to a mere coach about that, or, oh, you should never discuss that with your soccer coach or your paraprofessional counselor at your church. People talk to who they feel comfortable talking to. And many people don't feel comfortable talking to a designated professional. Now, my therapist colleagues don't like this, but this is nothing new. This is nothing new. My concern is that when people are looking for help, they recognize they need it. They acknowledge that they are experiencing challenges. I just want to help them, at least the ones who come into contact with my work, my body of work, I want to help them know if they're in the right place or not.
Hey, it's Diane with a quick interruption to the episode, because I've got a couple questions I just need to ask you. One, are you where you want to be in your business? Are you making the money you want to make, working the hours you want to work, seeing the clients that you want to see, and getting the income and impact that you went into business to get? And if the answer is no, what's holding you back? Why is there a gap between where you are and where you want to be? Do you know the answer? In my experience working with female solopreneurs, so many of them don't even really know what's standing in their way, and that is so frustrating. So I created a little quiz called What's Holding You Back? There's a link to it in the show notes. If this is you, please take the quiz. And if you do, DM me on Instagram at Coach Diane Wingert and let me know your results. Now, on the other hand, if you already know what's holding you back, if you already know what the obstacles are that are getting in your way from achieving the income and impact that you deserve and desire, then I don't want you to take the quiz. Forget about the quiz. Go directly to the other link in the show notes and book a consult with me. I may be the very coach, and this may be the year that you put all of that behind you and really have the business that you went into business to have. For everybody else, keep on listening. And if you find value in what you hear, don't forget to leave me a rating and review on Apple or wherever you're listening. Here we go, back to the show.
So I remember when we talked about what you introduced as habit stacking, so pairing your habits. And when you did initially bring that up, my initial reaction was like, ugh, like that sounds awful. Like, I don't want to do that. But that was like one of the first shifts that our work together had changed. And that is something that I'm grateful for every day. So the first thing I do in the morning is I go pee. And so what your advice was, take your medication, you know, right after, have your glass of water there in the bathroom. And so that's sort of my daily routine is going to the bathroom, taking my medication, contacts, coffee. Yeah. And it's great because it just cuts out any chance of forgetting, which then would lead to kind of lollygagging around and then like, oh, wait, have I taken it? I should take it. Wait, but this one other thing. And so just that really starts off the day so consistently and well. So that is the first thing. And then with regards to the rest of my morning routine, my best friend and I, we live together and we exercise in the morning now. So we've been doing that for the past 4 months, like at least 4 days a week. And so we do Beachbody and it's just really fun because we do have the accountability of there's going to be someone waiting for you. So your butt better be up.
If we want to set some kind of guidelines, I would say this. The big four for me, abuse, trauma, addictions, and loss. If you need healing, if you need insight, if you need to understand what happened, why it happened, how you feel about what happened, if you're still struggling to process it, work it through, adjust, cope, that for most people is going to be a therapeutic relationship that will be the safest and will give you the best outcome. For people who are looking to grow, experience personal growth, become more successful, become more consistent, reach for their personal goals with greater effort, more confidence, there are many, many good coaches that can help in that regard. I sometimes say that many of the people who choose to work with me are therapy graduates. They have dealt with things from their past in therapy. They have experienced the benefits of healing and insight. But now they're kind of thinking, okay, what's next? At that point, I don't really think continuing to work with a therapist makes a lot of sense. And that was actually one of the signals to me that I started recognizing that there were clients who were kind of done with therapy and they needed sort of that next level intervention. And I wanted to be the person to help them get to that next level. It was how I first started entertaining the notion of becoming a coach, in many cases for people who had seen a therapist. And I do not think for the record that you can do therapy and coaching with the same person at the same time. It's messy, it's confusing, and it's a dual role, dual relationship that would be very difficult on the boundaries. I do not know for a fact whether many people can successfully work with both a coach and a therapist at the same time. I'm sure there are people who are. I imagine it could be expensive and time consuming. But in an ideal situation, if someone is working with a therapist and there are very clear-cut boundaries, they're also working with a coach and there are very clear-cut boundaries, and everybody knows their role and their scope of practice, I think that can definitely work. For most people, I think it would work better if it was sequential, meaning do the therapy first, then do the coaching. In rare situations, I could imagine working with a coach and then something traumatic happened, or an abusive relationship happened, or a serious loss happened while someone was already working with a coach. And then they would either add on a therapist for a period of time or take a break from coaching and come back to it later. Along the lines of safe practice and scope of practice, I'm seeing a lot of references to seem like all of a sudden, and I do think this is related to the COVID pandemic, because there's nothing like a global crisis of this scope and nature to suddenly get a lot of people in touch with their unhealed trauma, not to mention the pure trauma of all we have collectively and individually lived with for the last 2+ years. So I suspect it's at least partially in reaction to that, but I'm suddenly seeing a great number of trauma-aware, trauma-conscious, trauma-focused, trauma-informed messages on social media. I do not think there are that many legitimate, highly credentialed programs training all those people based on the number of people who are now using this. It's almost like a marketing slogan that it seems like many people have adopted as if having experienced some personal trauma meant you were trauma-informed. No, you might not even be healed. And nothing makes me more worried for potential clients than being in an active state of trauma and hiring an untrained coach who simply markets themselves as trauma conscious or trauma informed. This is some very shaky ground. For the record, if I had someone come across my notice and someone was looking for a referral, I wouldn't send a person in acute state of trauma to just any therapist. I would send them to a trauma specialist because it really is a niche within the mental health industry, and not everyone does it well, for a fact. So I'm not overly impressed with credentials. I am definitely not impressed with certifications. Most of the certifications out there are completely made up, and I think they are marketed to people who genuinely believe that they will feel more prepared, they will feel more competent, they will feel more confident to work with people in pain if they have these certifications. I'm going to tell you, no, you won't. No, you won't. It takes a lot longer than you think to really be able to effectively work in these areas. And I say this from the perspective of someone who trained at UCLA and worked in some of the finest institutions in Southern California for many years. This is not about me justifying my path. I don't need to do that. And I couldn't possibly know what your path should be. But don't be so easily persuaded to invest in this program or that program, this credential or that credential, this certification or that certification. I cannot tell you how many very earnest, very well-meaning, very caring individuals who literally have credentials and certifications up the wazoo, they still feel anxious, uncertain, and full of doubt when working with certain clientele. So many people talk about imposter complex. That's another, it's like a coaching buzzword. And trust me, I have talked about it too. I'm sure I have recorded at least one episode on imposter complex. I don't remember if I called it imposter complex or imposter syndrome. Definitely one of my earlier episodes. I know for a fact I did. I just don't remember which number episode at this time. But, you know, the longer I'm in this industry and the more I hear people talk about imposter complex, the more I start to think, is it really always imposter complex? Or is it your inner wisdom informing you that you are just out of your scope? What this person needs, what this person wants, what would truly be healing for this person that you're thinking of working with or trying to work with or are working with? And you're feeling imposter. Are you really feeling imposter syndrome, or are you actually recognizing that you do not have what it takes to meet this person's need? That takes a lot of self-awareness and a lot of frickin' courage to even admit that. But if you really want to help people and you really want to create amazing outcomes, the kind that give you a really great reputation, people refer to you, and you're not constantly having to chase people on social media, there are worse things than to turn someone away and say, I don't think I can meet your needs. I do it. I do it now. For the record, even though I am a therapist, I am not currently working as a therapist. So if someone wants to hire me as a coach, and I assess them because I assess every potential client before I invite them to work with me, if I know they want to hire me as a coach, but they actually need a therapist, I will send them to a therapist. They probably won't go, but that's not for me to determine. Sometimes it's not imposter syndrome or complex. I wish I'd know which one it really is. It doesn't matter. Tomato, tomato. But sometimes it is your own intuition, your own instinct, your own awareness that I don't really know what I'm doing here. It's a very humbling moment. Trust me, I've had many of these moments at different stages in my career, but nothing feels better than being honest with yourself about that. And if you need to release the person so that they can go find the right helper, it's a great relief for you both. A couple of other thoughts on this. There's a difference in the payment model, therapy versus coaching. Therapy tends to be a pay-as-you-go. So you buy basically 1 hour, one 50-minute hour of therapy for whatever the price is. And if you come back next week, you pay again. It has been that way for many years. One of the first things, oh, and by the way, a huge percentage of people never go back for the second session. A huge percentage of people go once and never go back. So clearly, there are a lot of barriers to therapy actually going on long enough to make a difference. I don't think all those people got instant healing in one session. In fact, I'm certain that's definitely the exception rather than the norm. But with the pay-as-you-go model, there's a couple of things I want you to think about. If you are either considering hiring a therapist, hiring a coach, becoming a therapist, becoming a coach. Maybe you're a therapist who's thinking about venturing into coaching, or maybe you're a coach who's thinking about going back to grad school and becoming a therapist. Or maybe you have actually been a client of each of these different types of professionals. But I think the payment plan and the pricing structure is another distinction that has a lot of different variables. The pay-as-you-go plan, I think about decision fatigue. Because I do a lot of work around productivity with my clients. Decision fatigue basically references, even though you may have a standing appointment with your therapist, you actually have to make the decision to go each week, unless you've been going long enough that it is just what you do Thursdays at 4. It's just an unconscious habit, which I think has me concerned about the unconscious habit part of it. I mean, you should know why you're going and you should know what you're getting out of it, not just because it's what you do Thursdays at 4, like a nail appointment. But the paying as you go means each week when you realize, oh, it's 3:30, time to go see Serena, you have to make that decision fresh each week. Every therapist has a certain percentage of no-shows, late cancels, reschedules. And I think part of it is that needing to make the decision each week. It's also problematic because usually when you work with a therapist, it's same day, same time. And what happens if you just matched with someone on Tinder at 3:25? You probably don't feel like going to your therapy appointment. So I think that aspect of it is probably one of the reasons why most coaches offer packages. And why when you buy a package of X number of sessions or X many months of coaching or whatever, you are investing in a transformation over time from the beginning. I think in many cases, I think it's one of the reasons why so many therapists contact me, see if they can, quote unquote, pick my brain about the coaching industry. I see why it's appealing. Because if you're used to getting paid by the hour, and maybe sometimes people don't show up or they cancel at the last minute or whatever, getting paid for a package of sessions, you tell yourself, well, more consistent income and maybe more committed clients. Maybe it's possible. I think it's also just possible that therapy has been around for 100 years, coaching's been around for 20. Because coaching is such a new industry, it doesn't really have hard and fast rules. Like most therapists see their clients once a week for 50 minutes. Nobody really challenges that because it's been done that way for so long. But coaches can see their clients every week, every other week, once a month, every day, three times a week, on demand. The fact that it's an unregulated industry allows a lot of freedom. And I think that freedom is one of the reasons why highly educated, highly skilled, highly trained, and creative therapists like me became interested in coaching, because it allows you to do effective work in whatever way you and your clients agree to. But the package plan also has a caveat. I can see the appeal of it. I can see the appeal of it for the client. I can see the appeal of it for the coach. But it's problematic when you've invested in a coaching relationship and come to the realization that you're not getting what you came for. You are not getting what you paid for. You are not getting the return on the investment you expected. And most coaches will not take responsibility for that. And I'm talking about the vast majority of coaches. I know coaches who issue refunds. I have issued refunds. I have actually come to the realization with a couple of clients that it was not a good fit. I no longer believed that I could deliver the outcome we had agreed to. And I told them I was canceling their contract and refunding it. That's not something you do as a therapist, because you do not have a prepaid package of sessions. So there's a lot of differences and some similarities. The similarities are that it is an intimate relationship intended to help the individual seeking help. Whether they're looking to get better at dating, they are looking to overcome a lifetime long procrastination habit, they are looking to be more effective at interviewing for a job or advocating for themselves with a difficult boss, you can find a coach to help you manage your symptoms of ADHD. You can find leadership coaches to help you advance in the corporation you work for. I think there have never been more options than there are now, but with options comes two things in equal measure. One is freedom, and the other is responsibility. I think freedom is what all of us assume we have more of when there are more options. But once you've been burned a few times, once you have made investments, whether it's a coaching program or a coaching relationship, and realized this is not what I thought I was getting and I can't get my money back, you actually recognize that with more options, more opportunities, and more freedom, you actually need to take a greater level of responsibility for fact-checking, for doing your homework, for looking beyond the sexy copywriting and the beautiful website and the glowing testimonials, and check in with your insight and your intuition, and do some checking around. Interview a few people. And when you do, ask some hard questions. The right coach for you will not be offended and will actually welcome the opportunity to work with someone at that level. I personally love that. I like working with people who are not at all passive about the coaching process. They know what they're looking for. They know who they are. They know what they need, what actually helps them, whether that's they need more guidance, they need more support, they need more resources, they need more accountability. They need to be challenged. They need to have a sounding board. I think the best coaching clients know who they are and what they need, and they give you the opportunity to partner with them in that growth. It's very rewarding. And it all comes down to my one last thought. Whether it's a therapist or a coach or one of each, bottom line, goodness of fit. I don't care how popular this person is. I don't care how many people rave about them or how many Instagram followers they have. Trust your gut. Trust your gut. Guts don't lie. And if it's a good fit, your gut will know. So let the message get all the way to your brain and act on that. I hope this was helpful. I will put a few additional resources for figuring out whether working with a coach or working with a therapist is right for you. And if as a result of listening to this, you realize, you know what, I'm a therapy graduate and I'm ready for my next level, and I think Diane Wingert might be just the person to help me get there, I will also drop a link to book a free consultation with me. It is the first step to working with me. And whether we choose to work together or not, I guarantee you will walk away with something you didn't have before. Okay, folks, that's it. And I will see you next week with an amazing guest interview.
You've been listening to the Driven Woman Podcast with Diane Wingert. Want more straight talk and strategy each week that will take you from spinning to winning? Don't forget to hit subscribe in your podcast player so you won't miss a single episode. Then head on over to the Driven Woman free and private Facebook group community. See you there.